Ulrich is a chain-smoking, tough-as-nails investigative journalist for the New York City newspaper, The Daily Bugle. Lois Lane is an award-winning, tough-as-nails reporter for the Metropolis newspaper, The Daily Planet. Chris Hoffman is not. He's the guy we got on a podcast. It's time for the Lane Ulrich Report with extra special correspondent, Chris Hoffman.
Episode of the Lane Ulrich Report. I'm your host, Chris Hoffman. Today's guest is Drew Zucker, and I said that with a lot of accent. My parents are from Germany, so the Drew Zucker is my good friend who's the guest today, and he is known for his title for IDW Canto that he does with David Buer. Canto has the original series and several sequels. We're going to be talking about those. He also worked on The House with friend of the show, Phil Seve. That was published by Dark Horse. Another couple IDW titles that he worked on was Skybreaker with Hoax Hunters writer and creator Michael Morrissey, and also Dave for IDW. And he is also one of the essential workers. He is an EMT for the New York City Fire Department. Drew, thanks for taking the time to chat with me today.
Thanks for having me. I like the enunciation of the name. I have a German friend who his favorite thing in the world when he would see me is go, Zucker!
Yeah. It's in my blood. I can't get rid of it. You know what I mean? So if I see that, it's me and my dad talk about when we're talking about Facebook, it's Zuckerberg.
Yeah.
You know? Yes. So there's... Yeah, so it was also like a recovery there. Anyway, Canto is like your most prolific comic. It's got the you've got your main one, two numbered sequels. There's Canto 2 and 3. 3 is Lionhearted, and then there are two other
There's a one shot and two miniseries, but those three effectively make up, we call them side quests, and they're all kind of it started off as us doing one shots, and then it became you guys can kind of do more if you want, so we started expanding out.
That's awesome. And so the first one came out in like 2019. Last time that I was looking up for this, that is a lot of content to have created in those books, because you're the you're the artist on these books, and so 22 pages a piece, somewhere around there, averaging, right? And you do like most of the heavy lifting on those pages.
I have drawn all interior pages with the exception of City of Giants, which was drawn by Sebastian Perez to try and give me a little bit of a break. It didn't work out that way. And then we recently did Canto Tales of the Unnamed World, which was our version of an anthology series. And we had Leanna Kangas come in. Jorge Corona did a story for us. And we were able to bring in a much smaller artist named Sean Daly, who David found, I think, through Instagram. And so we were able to give Sean, you know, published mainstream work, which was great. But other than that, it's
awesome.
The same
team. That's awesome. That is so cool. And but tell people a little bit, like, give us a little synopsis of what Canto is about.
Canto is about a little tin man who is part of a race of tin people. And when they're born, their hearts are removed and they're put into slavery. And his people have been enslaved for generations. They don't have names. They're not allowed to have stories or love. But Canto's in love with a little tin girl, and when her clock is damaged, he ventures out into the big world and escapes his bondage to try and find her heart. And, you know, what happens after that is, you know, the adventure of Canto discovering, you know, what's actually beyond the world that he knows and trying to, you know, free himself and his people from slavery.
Gotcha. And then, like, you mentioned that their hearts get removed. First off, they're these cute little chits. They're so neat and adorable. They're little, like you said, tin men, but they look like a knight out of the, what are the Kingdom Hearts characters. It's very they're short, and there's a their hearts get taken out, but and it's replaced with a clock. And then that clock, when the clock is expires, that's when they expire. Yeah, it's really cool. So there's a lot of parallels. There's a lot of like parallel storytelling going on in the story. So to keep the spirits up of his love interest, he tells a story about a great hero who goes on a great adventure and saves people, and then he goes on that quest, and it doesn't necessarily go as well as the way that he's describing it to people, and not for any fault of his. It is just that there's one thing to just kind of telling a story about a hero and kind of becoming
so
one.
That was something that we looked at. And, you know, that element of it is very much David. David brought that whole thing into it. But the main thing that, even from before David being a part of it, that was always there, was that it's an all-ages book, but it cannot shy away from more hefty topics. I come from the era of Ghostbusters, 90s, TMNT movie, you know, Neverending Story, Secret of NIMH, all these things that, like, you know, you watched all this. I watched all this stuff growing up, and then I understood what I was watching, obviously. But then when you're an adult, you come back to it and you're like, probably shouldn't have watched that when I was a kid. Like, that's pretty heavy stuff. But what I've realized is that when you're a kid, you take the broad strokes from it. You don't take the you know, the smaller details per se. And that's kind of what we really shot for with Canto, was we wanted an all ages book that could literally speak to everyone, so that if we got young readers in, like at 10 years old, if they come back to it when they're 17, 18, whatever, they have a totally different, you know, reading experience with it than they did at that age. And based on the feedback we've gotten so far, it seems like we've actually managed to hit that nail.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to ask you like the inspirations for this, but you mentioned a bunch of those that are those 80s and 90s Secret of NIMH. I'd say like Gremlins is sort of in that vein. That's really cool. The design aspect from this. So first off, just like how did you get into art in the first place, and specifically into comic book art?
I come from a family of artists. My grandmother was an art teacher. She is now 106, sits in a nursing home, happy as can be, and somehow manages to draw more than I do. my father's a great artist. My sister is a really good artist in her own right. So it's just something that's always been around the household, and it's, you know, what I've always been naturally inclined to kind of go and do. I would say that until I got to college, it wasn't really something I was pursuing. You know, because you struggle through it, and then eventually things start to click together, and then that's kind of all you want to go and do. So then,
yeah, especially comics. I think it was like Jack Kirby said, comics will break your heart.
True.
And like you really shouldn't, like, another friend from here, Doug Wagner, always, Doug, who's got Plush, just came out from Image. He always tells the students, that you have to love doing this. It has to be like a passion. If you don't have a passion for it, if you're in it for a paycheck, you're probably better off selling like real estate or something.
I have a saying that one of the things I'm sickest of hearing from people is that I didn't get into – you'll never get rich in comics. And I've always said this is the most defeatist, nonsensical bullshit argument I've ever heard in my life. You can get rich in comics. You just have to know how to do it, because the world is not – what it was in the 90s or even the aughts. It's just you have to be paying attention to what the industry's doing. I'm in agreement with Doug, though, that you have to really love what you're doing. This is not a, you know, I'm going to do 8 hours of work and that's going to be enough. No, the thing I really love about making comics is that it is simultaneously a team sport, but a very individual effort. And, you know, for me, what I'm continually chasing is perfection. It doesn't exist. And I'm continually getting better. I'll go back to the original issues of Kanto, and we will have to actively stop me from redrawing the entire thing, because I look at it and go, this is trash and I can do it better now. But that's kind of the mindset you have to have. You have to be borderline obsessive about what you're doing, and you have to just, this has to be what you want to, where you want to be. It can't be, I want to go and make Netflix shows. I want to go and do this. You can generate IP, but what you need to care about is ultimately that 22 pages of story that you're telling, that's what you want to be the version of it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was going to ask you about, I did notice that. I reread the first series of Kanto this morning in preparation for this, and then started going through some of the sequels, and you can certainly tell, because Kanto number one, it's a great book and the storytelling is awesome and the artwork is wonderful, but you can tell the leveling up that you've gone through the subsequent through the subsequent issues. So when you're working on that, is this sort of a it happens as you're creating the next book, or do you have like purposeful like practice in between? Is there like a set of books or whatnot that you check out, or are you picking this up from like books that you read?
It's a mix of practice and it just kind of evolving. Kanto, I would say, is probably a really specific example of it, because I'm spending so much time with that character and in that world. You just eventually begin to find shortcuts, or you begin to find, you know, minor adjustments that you're making without even realizing it, until all of a sudden you have the version, and that's the version that you're drawing. But it's a mix of, you know, knowing where I'm weak and where I need to practice and what I want to get better at. And before we start every arc, I usually sit down before I even have scripts, and I make a list of what I want to really do with an arc, whether that's expand out environmental shots and grow kind of the scale of what we're doing, you know, improve within, you know, the action sequences of what we're doing. That, you know, that's kind of how I like to approach projects before we even get started. So I have a base and a touchstone to always go back to.
Yeah. Okay. Very cool. Do you hit, you're in New York. Do you hit the convention there? Have you as a fan, and have you tabled there?
I have never done it as a fan. I have, since 2007, have been going looking for work and peddling my wares ever since. I love New York. San Diego is a more recent one for me. So for me, San Diego is the pilgrimage, and New York is the show. I actually think I'm probably going to get flack for it, but whatever. I actually think New York is the bigger show of the bunch, based purely on the fact that I think the Javits Center lends itself a little more to the grandiose nature of things. I love New York. I've tabled there. I haven't tabled in a couple years. Actually, right before Kanto came out, I did Emerald City. And Emerald City, I did the show. Show was fine. But it let me know that that tabling was not working for me anymore. And that I needed to take 2 years, was the timeline I gave myself, to then, you know, just work. And make it so tabling had more purpose, because otherwise I was just sinking. I was sinking resources, money, time. You know, traveling for these shows is a killer. It's time off from work, which means I'm not really drawing. So I decided to take those 2 years off, and in the 2 years, the world decided to end, and the plague showed up. So that has kind of delayed my return to to tabling, but I'm hoping for next year I'll be able to table at a few shows.
Right on. That's really cool. No, that's great to hear. I would love to. The thing about New York Comic Con is I'll watch sometimes, especially during the pandemic, I was watching like YouTube videos of people walking the lanes, right? And checking out the artist alley. And New York is an insane one because it's like, oh, there's the best artist I've ever seen, you know? And then the next table over, it's like, oh, no, wait, this is the best artist I've ever seen.
My favorite part about New York is it's effectively two shows. It's the trade show slash pop culture convention upstairs, and what is downstairs is a straight up Comic-Con where you can go and see the biggest artists that this industry has to offer all just hanging out down there, just like, hi, what's going on? And it's just like, it's awesome. The Artist Alley in New York is a completely separate show, and it's amazing.
Gotcha. That's incredible. Yeah, I would love to make it out to that one of these days.
It's worth a trip.
And yeah. No, certainly. I did Emerald City the first time it came back from the pandemic. It was a very nice show. Very cool to lots of really fun people there. But not seeing a ton of the publishers, right? Like, so you were saying you used to go to the shows and get a chance to talk to publishers and editors and stuff like that. That seems like there's a lot of companies that are looking at their balance sheet and being like, why do we pay, you know, $5,000 to be at a show when we have that, looking for talent, we'll look at Instagram.
That price
tag
is way up there. It's a six-figure number to do those shows. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm taught. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, for New York and stuff like that. Yeah,
you're right, though. It definitely, there has been a... The industry goes through, I call them silent shifts. And it happened when I graduated college and I figured it out very quickly. So I was able to pivot. I think they're in the middle of another one. I'm not 100% sure everybody has figured out exactly what it is. I have some concept of it, but there is a shift that, like, if you're trying to break in right now, it's hard. I mean, even I have what a lot of people would deem to be a successful book. I still, on a daily basis, don't feel like I broke in. Yeah, but that's my own imposter syndrome.
No, I get it. That I don't know that anybody ever feels like they've broken in. You could be in the industry for like 20 years and still feel like, well, you know, it could all get taken away tomorrow. But yeah, like that breaking in, that's a really good point. It seems like whatever way, like if I have guests on here and I say, hey, how do you break into the comic industry? You know, it's like, I broke in like 10 years ago. It doesn't work that way anymore. Like, you have to do it in a completely different way.
The one piece of advice I give people, and I think it's probably going to be the one true thing to the end of time, is you have to just go make a book. You have to go out there and you have to want to do it and go and produce it and show them that you're willing to go and do that. But there's a caveat to this, because I had dinner with friends who showed me the pitch for their fantasy book. And I told them, you know, listen, this is good. I can tell you right off the bat, this is not IDW Dark Horse good. They won't take it. And that's not me being a jerk. That's me just being honest with them.
Sure.
But I told them that the reality of it is that you're creating a fantasy book that you want is in all ages. You're in direct competition with me.
Sure.
You better be prepared to work as hard as I do, if not harder, which is, it's a lot of hours and I'll go till I fall over. That's kind of how this works, is that if you're going to be in you're always in competition with everybody. And you, not to say be you know, a douche about it, you know, just be nice to everybody, be professional. But that's kind of how you have to continually see it, is that I'm always on the back foot. And if you're always on the back foot, then you're always working to get in front.
No, that makes a lot of sense. It's a lot of work. It doesn't work out, not for everybody. Maybe it would work for someone, but it doesn't work that you produce one issue of a comic And then right. The paychecks roll.
Oh, and Marvel God, calls. No, I wish that were the case.
Yeah, producing one book is hard enough. Producing a 5-issue series is that much harder and more expensive. You have the I don't want to say luxury, but like you're the guy who is building everything. You don't have to go to a team of people to finish up your pages, which is what my team usually has to do. We're paying a penciler and an inker and a colorist, and so that starts to get into cash and a capital. It's not unheard of for a comic to cost $10,000 for one issue.
I don't get paid page rate for Canto. Mm-hmm. I've actually never been paid a page rate outside of cover work. This is all by design, mm-hmm. though, that I'm very lucky that mm-hmm. I work with very like-minded people who share this same unhealthy obsession for these 22 pages of something. But it's always mm-hmm. been in service of protecting IP and ownership over something. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of how mm-hmm. I've played it. I've been very fortunate that these things are now, you know, after Canto's got to be coming up on 5 years of actually being in production, and I want to say 10 years since inception. Mm-hmm. These, mm-hmm. you know, I'm lucky that it's beginning to pay dividends back to me, but, you know, that's, I've always known that that's I'm gambling on myself, effectively.
Sure. You know, the 10-year time frame sounds, I've heard that from several different people, that that's about
I
how
was
long
told,
it, I, it takes.
I was and, told by Matthew Dow Smith in a bar that when he and I met, I think I was in year two post-graduating, and he told me mm-hmm. if it doesn't happen for you in 10 years, it's not going to happen. And it happened at year 8. And I talked to Matt on, you know, a fairly regular basis through social media, but that guy's always been a bastion of brutal honesty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a few of those guys in the industry that you can get like just straight answers from, because it can be also a little pie in the sky. I don't want to like discourage anybody from doing stuff. It's just, you got to understand it's hard work. It's not something, it's like anything else. You want to be an Olympic swimmer, got to train. You want to do this, you got to work at it. But you can, there's ways you can get popular on social media, and then you have your own audience, and there are people who do very successful books and never touch a publisher.
But I mean, you know, when you get that book done and like you're able to start getting it into people's hands, that's the best feeling in the world. Like when you physically get to hold the fruits of your labor, which is very cool.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. So you were talking about like ways of getting this into people's hands. There's a new way that is that's really popular in comics and a lot of collectibles right now, and it's Whatnot, which is a live auction site. I have a friend plug for Captain _ Electric, who on Whatnot, who he sells. Yep. He has a lot of books. He doesn't like being known for it, but he sells a lot of cheesecake stuff, which is great. I told him, lean into it, man.
That's
be
what
the guy
I've told him.
Who sells that stuff, because that's real popular on Whatnot.
I've told him the same thing. Don't hide from it. Do it. It's actually kind of missing from the platform.
Yeah. Yeah. Do it, man. Like that's people struggle, like artists like ourselves struggle their whole lives to try to find a thing to be known for. Right. We'd love to be known for something. And if it ended up being something I don't like, I would still, you could always leverage it into something else,
exactly.
You know, later on if you wanted to,
exactly.
You know what I mean? But Whatnot. So you had, Canto had some exclusive, covers for, some fourth and fifth printings of the books. Tell us about that experience. Like, what was it like working to get that done?
Whatnot came to us through, Jack DeMeo, who was one half of Simple Man Comics. Hmm. A couple of years ago. And Jack and, at the time, his streaming partner, Brian, they found Canto before its release, and we ended up having a 2-hour conference interview with them. And it was amazing. And I credit them with a ton of the success of this book, especially when it came to secondary market. They championed this thing to no end. And David and I we would have talked to a garbage can about it during the start of this whole thing. But as time went on, Jack eventually came to Whatnot to bring comics onto the platform. And I was one of the first people he reached out to about it. And I know he had reached out to a ton of people that never got back to him. But I was like, you know what? I really like Jack, and I owe him enough to have the conversation. I had the conversation with him about what this platform is. I was like, I kind of get it, I think, and I will give it a shot. I did it, and I found it to be immensely successful. David was followed shortly after, and it just kind of worked out that Jack has always championed Canto so hard that when it came time for them to want to, you know, really expand the comics end of this into the platform, he asked if Canto could be a part of that. So that's how we got to that first, that fourth printing of issue one. And that was a massive success. And that's now translated into this massive partnership that's been variant covers, the recent trading cards that have been going crazy, and, you know, a bunch of other stuff that's come in for 23.
That's awesome. I love this idea, because they were, I thought, you know, what a weird thing, right? To have the live auctions in, what an old timey, you know, type of thing, show up and buy a horse or a cow or something like that in a live auction. But it's serving a market that's interested.
So funny though, because effectively I realized it after my first show. I was like, oh my God, it's Artist Alley. It's Artist Alley on your phone. And especially when COVID hit, that was just like, you know, this is now everybody can interact with you. Because it's funny, because I'd been trying to set up with shops right before Whatnot had come along, this idea that, you know, some of the larger shops, we do a mail-in signing. And so it's like, you know, 15 bucks, they'll send us the books, we split everything up and all that. But then we set up like an hour-long, you know, Zoom call with everybody that got a book signed. So, you know, and the idea was, we've only got so many resources and so much time. How do we reach areas that are underserved, or for people that go into San Diego or New York or a convention that's not an option, but still give them the ability to interact with, you know, creators or whoever. And it ultimately never came to fruition anywhere. But Whatnot kind of came along right after and introduced this platform that allows me to be able to do that. And now it's, you know, they've parlayed it into publishing, and I know that there is a degree of animosity about the platform. I also think that this industry is notorious for complaining about anything that will come its way. I'm a firm believer that the industry is very much stuck in a rut, and either the publishers are either unwilling or unable to dig themselves out of it. And what that's going to mean is that you need somebody to come in that's going to have a lot of money and a lot of ability to maneuver. And, you know, like it or not, Whatnot has these things, and they love comics. They obviously have to serve what the platform is in addition to publishing, but this industry needs a shakeup, because if it doesn't get one, it's going to just fall by the wayside.
Certainly. Well, I can imagine, like, what did the direct market do to the market that was in 7-Eleven, right? Like, you didn't get them there anymore. That was a shift in the industry, and it's not one that we all lament anymore. You know, it's not one we were like, oh, if they only still sold comics at 7-Eleven, you know.
I figured out a couple years ago that there was a lot of money to be made in comics, but the old way of doing it is not feasible anymore. The way I see it is that the direct market is not the primary market anymore. And before any retailers freak out, it is not – they are a completely essential part of it. What you get now are multiple smaller markets that you have to serve each one of them. And by serving in each one, you're creating your larger you know, ball that would – that would make up your business. The direct market just there's a certain volume that it can handle, and it can only handle so much before there has to be outreach. I think the industry kind of missed the lesson that when they freaked out about digital, that digital ultimately didn't cannibalize print. It actually made print stronger. And that's a lot of what's going on now. Now you have multiple versions of that, but it's a lot of work to be able to serve all of these different areas.
Certainly. So the market, it's fragmented.
I think so.
Fairly similar to the way that the music industry.
I think that's actually most entertainment at this point is extraordinarily fragmented. The idea of one giant market is not, it's not feasible anymore because everybody's got so many different ways to access things. So you have to go where they are. You can't just play the one game and expect them to meet you there.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. The like television is now competing with TikTok and other social medias and stuff. It's not that audiences are gone. It's just they're in different places. And comics have certainly fragmented a lot. I mean, because we can just be honest. Like there was. Also, the huge market was only serving like one kind of customer, right? Like now in comic books, you can go out and you can find there's a comic for any interest, you know, for any group, for any comics or for everybody. And so and that that fragmentation, if you look at all of this from just Marvel and DC's point of view, yeah, it is disappointing because they just don't own everything anymore. Right. And but that's you combat that with better product. Right. Not just with less access to other people's products.
You know, I'm a firm believer that it is not, and you know, shoot myself in the foot here with this. It's not the big two that will make the industry healthy. They're fine. They're owned by parent companies. These things they have nothing to worry about. To me, the health of the industry is based around its creator-owned books. I've told people all the time, you want to be the person that is in the know of your friends and finds that thing that's going to be the popular TV show in 10 years and be able to tell them, I knew about this way back when. It's in creator-owned comics. It's not necessarily in books anymore. The best work is being done with those books.
Well, and you can see it because there's a lot of people who are moving from other industries into comics, the people that used to write for. It used to be the case that you would write for a like Kevin Smith, like he'd write movies and TV shows and stuff like that. And then he was like, oh, I'll slum it in comics for a while. Not slum it. He loves comics. And so he wanted to do that. But
yeah, no,
get what
I
I'm saying. You know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, I'll, you know, it was the other way around. Now it's totally the other way around. It's like, I heard that from several people that said, if you want to work in Hollywood, you need to have a popular comic book first, because that's where all the proving ground. And it makes sense because it's taken all of the risk out of trying out people that have an 100%. Unproven product, right? Like if your book is proven, it sells, people are way more likely to be able to take a chance with licensing your book into a show, toy line, video games, whatever, because you're like, I'm already bringing an audience with this. You don't have to try this untested IP.
It's also easier just to visually be able to show them it. you know, they can look at something, whether they read it or not, you know, they'll flip through it, and within 30 seconds, you know, it's like editors, within 30 seconds, they know if they're going to hire you. You know, this lets them go, oh, I'm not interested. Okay, goodbye. Oh, this is interesting. Okay, in the pile. Yeah, I mean, I will say I think the Hollywood stuff, I kind of lament it all the time, even though I'm a part of it now. But it's that if you're making books just to go to Hollywood, you will inevitably fail at probably both. The way we've always approached it is, and I have this fight all the time, and it's something that I have to champion within our business interest everywhere, that if the book is not the core of what we're doing, if this is not phenomenal, none of this matters. This is all ancillary. This is all fun, and I'm happy to go and do it. I'm happy to go make a movie. I'm happy to go make cards and toys and whatever else. If that book is not the best experience that I can give someone, though, that when they sit down and read it, they feel invested in it, all of this is for nothing. Because they won't go to any of the other stuff at that point. What you need is for them to be invested in what it is you're doing. And it's why I'm like, you know, I'll go play in other industries. I'll go do other stuff. But ultimately, I just want to sit around and kind of draw my little doodles and make my little book.
Yeah, for sure. Like, there would be nothing wrong with, like, a DreamWorks movie coming out, and then you could just sit and draw all the time, right? You know what I mean? There's benefits to the side of that, for sure. But, yeah, if you're creating a fan base, they're going to be the people. And I think this is every marketing business book's advice, right, is cater to your core audience, and everything else will kind of fall into place.
And we're very lucky with Canto that we have that core audience. We have a very very loyal group that consistently come back. And the amazing part is we're 4 years into this now, and we're still getting new people on board every day. And it's exciting that, you know, this deep into it, we're still able to bring people to the table and for them to be like, oh, this is really cool. And it's like, here, enjoy. That's why we made it.
That is really cool. Yeah. Oh, 100%. And that's people who like create comics and need like understand this, where it's like, that is part of the reward. That's why you do it for no money. You know what I mean? The money comes afterwards. But like you said, being able to bring people on board with the fan base and be a part of it is a lot of the reward. So you worked on a book called The House with a good friend of the show, Phil Seve. So tell people a little bit like the premise for that book.
The House is a World War II haunted house story. It's basically Band of Brothers meets the Amityville Horror. And the elevator pitch for it is that a group of soldiers, U.S. soldiers during the Battle of the Bulge, get separated from their line and lost in the woods. And they stumble across a house that has no rhyme or reason to be where it is. It is enormous, and they seek shelter inside, and once inside, all sorts of horrific shenanigans ensue. And, you know, it's a fun haunted house story. It's our love letter to that genre.
Yeah, beautiful book. And very, like, different art style. So you have like a stretch from the different things that you do. So how was your approach kind of different on this one than it is the working on Canto?
I don't think the approach was different as much as it was. That book is a really interesting period for me because I transitioned from all traditional into partly digital and then into all digital. And then inevitably for Canto ended up back half and half. The approach was the same that it was for Canto, essentially. It was a lot of research. It was a lot of...
It's a lot
of research, a lot of talking with, you know, in this case, Phil, and then working through it. And then, you know, once I have the script in hand, I get turned loose on it and I'll work through everything in thumbnails. I'll, you know, and once I have the thumbnails, I'll sit down with, in that case, Phil, and we'll talk through everything. And then at that point, it's usually I'm like, everyone, get away. I'm going to disappear for a few months. And that book shows up.
How do you split up? Yeah, nice. How do you split up the parts between the traditional and the digital? Which parts do you
now,
which?
Nowadays, it's all thumbnails are traditional, just for the sake of being able to be really sketchy and messy with it. All pencils are done digitally. If there is a, I'm inking more traditionally now than I used to, but usually when I need to speed up the pace of it, we'll go back to digital. But once it's penciled, I print it out onto blue line, onto paper, and then I ink it just the traditional way and then scan it back in.
Nice. That's kind of fun. I like that process because then you also have like an original that you can sell later.
It's the happy medium I've found with it. And my inks, regardless of the blue line, they are the original art at the end of the day. Because I'll, you know, my what I've always found is that my pencils sometimes, even when they're, I pencil pretty tight. But even when I finish my pencils, not always a guarantee I got it right. So I, it's not uncommon for me to, you know, especially when I print stuff out to, just either rebuild my structure over faces or to, you know, make sure that things are exactly where they should be.
Mm-hmm. That makes that's super cool. I love that. So you mentioned sort of like this mix of traditional and digital. We were talking before we started recording that the big to-do of the day right now, we're talking during a hinge event in human history, the release of ChatGPT, which is a AI that's a text AI that works like magic. I can't been playing with it for the last few days, and with I keep calling it Majestic something.
Was it Midjourney
Midjourney. Thank you. Gosh, you had to correct me on that twice now. Midjourney AI, which is an artificial intelligence that has been fed a bunch of artwork, some of it not credited to the artists. And but you put in a text prompt of some sort, and then it generates an image based on your text prompts, and then you can refine that image. So if you wanted a picture of Superman and he's really sad and he's sitting in a dark alleyway with rain on him or something like that, you put in the right set of prompts into this robot and it spits out an image for you. But it's the big to-do. Like, there's a lot of like protests online right now that are going on, that people saying that they're upset about the way that artists' art is being used in it and not being credited. I want to get you kind of your take. Like, what's your initial take, and like, what's your like refined
take? The initial take is about that level of it.
For the people who are listening, there's an audio version of this too. Drew's telling me I'm number one here, is what it looked like with your hand. That's a New York howdy, I hear. Yes.
All right. So the refined take on it. I think it's, I told you I had heard a take on this that I had never considered. So I'll leave that for the end. My initial take is that it's garbage, and ultimately it's theft. I don't see a future where it can eliminate artists, because ultimately if it's stealing from other artists, the legal ramifications that a company is opened up to are enough to be sued into the next century. It just is not a viable thing. The arguments, I remember right after Jung Ji Kim died, somebody managed to recreate his art in 3D. I personally thought it was the most disgusting thing I've ever seen in my life, and I thought the person should get a good crack upside the head. But his take on it was, why, you know, what's the issue? I've recreated this thing we all love. And it's like, well, that's not the point. Not only have you not recreated it the way that he would draw, because he was extraordinary, the point is that nothing lasts forever. When you get, you know, inevitably we all reach the end at some point. I personally do not want a computer regenerating Jack Kirby, or Neil Adams, or anyone. Their work that they produced when they were alive was born from their life experience, from their skills, from their hard work, and that's ultimately what made it what it is. And short of Skynet becoming a thing, it's never going to be able to duplicate it. It will only ever be able to imitate it. And that is why it will never be able to fully replace artists. The upside to this that was presented to me today that I had never considered was that this is ultimately technology. And what could potentially come along 10 years down the road is, let's say you have an artist that's had a stroke. They regain some of their hand or their motor function to be able to draw. Comics are super labor intensive. As you get older, you saw it with Joe Kubert. Mm-hmm. From when he was a young man to when he was much older, the art changes. The nature of getting older. There is a scenario where AI art, if let's say you took all of Joe Kubert's art and fed it into a program, he could then use that to assist him in creating work that is no longer a 14-hour labor of love, but instead it's a 2-hour workload for a guy in his 80s who still wants to create the way he used to and use this as an assist. That to me is a more interesting is a much more interesting use of it than, say, you know, the idea that you're generating original art from it.
Yep.
I can
you still hear me?
I just lost the picture.
Okay, my camera just went out. Hang on a sec. Oh, give me a break here. What's going on? Okay, I will just put a picture of me up when I edit the video. If you can still hear me, it's still recording. So, no, that's a good point. I thought we're in a frontier of weird computer stuff that I don't know how. I think there will be stuff that comes out of it that is good. There will be things that we can use and whatnot. Like, I always go back to this, like. So talking about movies, right? I felt like there was a huge difference between the Crow movie with Brandon Lee, right? Where that movie was almost done and he was tragically killed on set, and they finished it because it was like, hey, this was the last work that he did. And it's a really good movie, and let's get this finished. Then you've got the other side of it where you have like the third Disney Star Wars.
God.
Where Carrie Fisher's gone, you know what I mean? She's straight up, you know, just bring her straight back from the dead.
They just weakened it, Bernie's her. Which is, listen, that's how I want to go.
Yes,
but
it feels like
that felt inappropriate.
It feels a little bit like when like Jesse James was shot and they put up his body in the middle of the town square and you could pay a quarter and get a photo with it. It's like,
there is a degree of that.
To me, you know what I mean? Nothing against, I feel like that people were like good intentions that were poorly put together there. And that feels like the same thing that's part of this. It's like, we're going to have ethics discussions about all of these technologies,
100%.
Right?
And that I think is is ultimately what it comes down to, is that ethics is a part of this. There's a reason scientists and doctors and everyone, you know, is taught ethics. You're supposed to have these hard debates. I know no one wants to have a hard debate in this world anymore, because it may offend them, or people are just so entrenched in their way of thinking. But hard debate is not a bad thing. And this is something that I'm with you. I think ultimately there may be some truly phenomenal good things to come from this. In the meantime, though, it's kind of like, come on, man, really? This is, one, not going to replace you. And two, it's the thing of the moment. Eventually, it'll be forgotten. It'll be used for certain things, but I don't see it replacing, you know, what is either in concept art, extraordinarily talented people, or in storytellers, people that mm-hmm. have a story that they want to tell. It can't generate your ideas.
Right. Yeah. I think, like you said, there will be a use for it. And I think one of the nice uses will be for it is that concept artists are expensive sometimes mm-hmm. for some people. You know what I mean? If you're a person just on your own trying to build out something, and you have like a pitch packet or something like that you have for somebody, and you're like, you know, a futuristic looking car to kind of describe my idea would be cool to have with this. It might put a tool into someone's hands that could help elevate their work. It might be an accessibility issue, yeah. which is cool. I think somebody who doesn't have access to resources but would still give them an access to be able to solidify an idea to inspire from. So if, like, you want to figure out certain lighting, like you have a difficult pose in Canto somewhere, you know what I mean? You're like, you know what? I just got to figure out the light on this guy's face. Like, you and I would probably go to Google and look for light on face and then have that picture up on the screen and do a yeah. sketch of it, right? Like, as a reference. I think as a reference tool, it might be real interesting to be like, okay, I'll put up a picture of Superman to get the right. logo right. You know what I mean? So it's like, how does it look when it's a 3/4 view, you know? Because I have trouble with
that's
that.
That's kind of, yeah.
But yeah.
That's where, like, it's going to come down to.
I think the fear of, like,
that's where it's going to come down to. It eventually develops into a tool. Right now, it's just straight jacking people's art. And that's an issue.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, 100%. That is, like, just the problem right now. Where it's like, oh, you're just stealing things. This is because it's not taking, it's only taking from the stuff right. that it's been fed, right? So it's not, they haven't been careful about saying, like, okay, this is all public domain art, or this is stuff that there's an artist who is interested in this technology and we're right. paying them for this, or they're creating it and they're volunteering for it. There will be ways to do that. Like, if there's, maybe they'll just have a team of artists that are like, you paint every yeah. brushstroke in blue that's possible, and then that gets fed into the machine, and then it comes
out.
But
I think that's
now,
a little less of the concern end of things. Mm-hmm. You know, because yeah. ultimately, you know, what you're talking about, where it's like, I struggle with doing 3/4 views. Struggle is where, you know, you get better. Like, if you're an artist, that I struggle all the time. It is not uncommon for Phil to get screenshots of pages and for me to be like, I don't know how to do it. Mm-hmm. Help me. and he'll give me his version of it. And from there, it helps me begin to figure out what it is I'm doing, or to reverse engineer something. But it's going to be an interesting ride over the next 10 years with this, to see what it does. Right now, I mean, there's definitely the stealing end of things is concerning to me, because we're in the age where people are just like, well, I don't steal things. It's like, download movies and comics? Yeah, well, then you're stealing. Like, sorry, dude. I have news yeah. for you. And it's like, you're not going to – it's one thing for you to do it with the $4.99 book, but you're not going to steal what is effectively my original art and my concepts and ideas and then feed it into a machine like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. That always – that always bothers me when I'm hitting the artist alley, and I know that there's artists that don't mean to do this, you know, but I also think there's a line, like you said, if it's a big corporate book and someone's drawing a picture of Captain America or something, you know what I mean? They got a nice Deadpool on their print list there. It looks great. If someone in the artist alley has like a Hellboy or a Canto or Bone or something like that, it's like, well, you're doing the same thing, but now it's one guy. You know what I mean? Or team, you know what I mean? So some of those are teams. But I mean, like, if you're just a big fan of Hellboy and you're selling like an unauthorized thing, you're like, ugh, that's one dude. Are you sure?
You really want just...
You want to be doing that?
We usually don't have the legal team, and we are not that friendly when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. 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 It'll be, like you said, it's super interesting, and it's popcorn, you know what I mean? To like watch, like, oh my gosh, who's going to, and when is Disney going to weigh in? You know what I mean? When are they going to just be like, all right, now you're cutting into the mouse's profits. Now the hammer's going to come down because there's money behind it.
I honestly don't think they ever will unless it starts to affect movies. They traditionally will not get involved in this stuff until it affects brand. So anything sexualized will get them on you really fast. But like stuff in Artist Alley, for them, I was talking.
Oh, no, Artist Alley, I'm talking more about like the Midjourney stuff, know what I mean? Where it's like, oh, what are you feeding in there? Yeah, Artist Alley, I know that they're hands off, I think they should be. They want like a celebration of their characters and their artwork and stuff like that. That's what's happening there. It's not even like Marvel print is a rounding error as far as Disney's concerned. That's true. What I mean? Like, let people have their fun with that stuff, you know. But no, I was being confusing.
If it goes into Midjourney, Disney will throw down the hammer for sure. That they won't put up with.
Yeah, I agree with that. So the next issue of Canto is going to be all AI
David's
generated,
gonna love
Like you're just
we announced
go
today
in.
That we're swapping roles. David's gonna draw and I'm gonna write, and it's gonna be a disaster. This is an absolute.
You're gonna save a bunch
this
of time.
This is an absolute joke. It's not happening. I promise.
Oh, I know. No. Totally kidding. Nope. That will be. I wonder when you're going to see that first AI generated comic. You know,
somebody
where
did
people
it.
Are going to be like,
it's bad. It's really bad. It's like
I believe it.
It's like, you know, Will Eisner wrote a book about visual storytelling that's outside of Scott McCloud's book is probably the go-to Bible to learn visual storytelling in comics, and it is just one sin after another. Like Will Eisner is going to come back from the grave and punch the computer out. That's how bad it is.
Gotcha. I remember when Marvel put out the very first 3D generated comic. I want to say it was a Spider-Man or something, and it was just
awful.
Terrible. I remember it being on the shelves for clearance years and years.
No.
Nobody wanted that
thing. Even if you go back to, like, Ultimate Spider-Man, those original Joe Q covers, the coloring in them is, like, it's funky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, weird new technology. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see where it goes. Well, when that becomes a new thing, we'll have you back here and we'll talk about it some more, and we'll see where it has moved in the time.
I'll be interested to have that conversation.
In the last couple of minutes here. Oh yeah. And there was a couple of things we didn't get to in this conversation, so we will certainly have to do this again. But in the meantime. In the last couple minutes here, where can people get in touch with you if they want to follow your work? Do you have like a social media channel that you like to
work on? All
the
medias. So I am on Facebook. There's a Drew Zucker art page. for those of you that are still on Facebook. On Instagram, I am at Art of Drew Zucker. On Twitter, I am at Drew_Zucker. On Whatnot, I am at Art of Drew Zucker. And if you are looking for my website, it is artofdrewzucker.com.
Awesome. So everybody, and Canto and the House and all of those books that we mentioned, there's a good chance that they are available at your local comic shop. And they are also available secondary market everywhere. Check out your and check out your website sometimes. So yeah, certainly jump on and hang out with you on your your Whatnot channel too.
I will be streaming.
It's a fun way to interact.
I will be streaming next Monday. I'll be dropping a new cover, and it's going to be my last show of the year. So I'm going to be uploading a whole bunch of stuff. A lot of auctions. A lot of buy it now. So you can come hang out, see what it's all about, and get a feel for how the platform works.
Nice. That'll be Monday, December 19th.
I want to say 6:30.
Awesome.
Eastern. If you find me on the platform, it's up there.
Yeah, jump onto Whatnot and find. Awesome. Yeah, and then subscribe so that you can be notified when your next shows are going to be coming on. And I'm sure you've got those when new issues are going to be coming out, announcing those on all your social channels.
Big time.
And we'll be retweeting and reposting, by the time. Yeah, that's another platform that's just going to fall into dirt and be something we talked about. Like, remember when Twitter was a thing?
That's a whole other conversation.
Maybe Midjourney can. Yeah, Midjourney can replace Twitter somehow. That's the prompt you got to put in there, is like replace a 120 character social media platform that we
Midjourney's going to create the physical embodiment of it.
That sounds
it's
horrifying.
Just the bird with legs, and it looks like Baba Yaga.
That's hilarious. Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for taking the time today. This was so much fun. And yeah, like I said, I hope you are not horrified enough that you will come back and talk to us again.
No, thank you for having me. This was a blast. I will absolutely be back.
Awesome. And I'll make sure I have a camera that works next time.
All right.
Oh, and you know what? I got to put in the plug. I always forget this at the end. Make sure that everybody subscribes to the world's greatest comic book podcast. The title of the show, Opinions Vary. Have a good evening.